This is continuing coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Session, you may be seated.
Your next witness, please, Mr. Lally.
Yes, Your Honor. The Commonwealth will call Mr. Timothy Nuttall to the stand.
Can you raise your right hand? Do you solemnly swear the evidence given to the court and jury of the case now and here and should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Thank you.
You can stand or sit, whatever makes you more comfortable, sir.
And just bring that microphone down to you. Thank you.
How's that?
Okay. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Lally.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, sir.
Morning.
Could you please state your name and spell your last name for the jury?
Timothy Nuttall. Last name is Nuttall, N-U-T-T-A-L-L.
And what do you do for work, sir?
I'm a firefighter paramedic with the town of Canton.
And how long have you been a firefighter paramedic in the town of Canton?
I believe 5 years and coming up on six.
And prior to working in that capacity with the town of Canton, what, if any, other employment have you had within sort of the same field as far as being a paramedic?
To back up significantly. I got my EMT certification when I was still in high school through CMTI out of Weymouth. They're now owned by Brewster Ambulance. From there, I was employed by Cataldo Ambulance. I worked primarily in the city of Chelsea, running BLS transfers and eventually 911 shifts in that that city and that area of the world, if you will. From there, I decided I liked it. I decided to enroll in paramedic school. I went to the same school I went for my BLS certification, back to CMTI. I obtained my paramedic right before I turned 21. I stayed in the same area, primarily in Chelsea, and eventually edged my way into Everett a little bit and worked up there for about 7 years. During that time, I decided to be a, enroll in to fire suppression side of things. So, I was hired by the town of Scituate. I was put through the Mass Fire Academy out of Stowe, class 268 in Stowe, and worked for the Scituate Fire Department for about 18 months, and then transferred to the Canton Fire Department in November of 2019.
Just a couple questions about what you had just spoken about. So when you use the term sort of BLS, what does that mean?
So in EMS, there's two kind of branches. BLS is basic life support, which is EMT basic. Smaller skill set, if you will. Still running 911 emergencies, but that was kind of the stepping stone to see if you could do the job, if you like the job, and then you can advance on to ALS, advanced life support, which is the paramedic side of things. That's a broader skill set, many more medications, many more interventions that we can perform in the field. Obviously, I enjoyed the BLS side, so I advanced to the ALS side.
Now, as far as starting with becoming an EMT, what, if any, you mentioned you went to a CMTI school, but what type of education do you require prior to getting any sort of graduating or certification or something like that? What are the classes like?
So it kind of runs the gamut for emergency medicine. You start mostly with anatomy and physiology, the human body. Progresses down to how those illnesses can progress and the natures of illness. Once that's kind of understood, then we advance on to pharmacology and interventions, just basic interventions that you can do. And then the basic interventions are further progressed into more advanced interventions throughout the program. Once you complete your didactic portion, where all that is kind of in the books, you then progress to clinical time, in hospital. I can't speak to the hours off the top of my head. I can't remember. But many hours in the hospital, and then you progress to your field ride time, where you're in the back of an ALS ambulance with a preceptor, performing those skills, being evaluated, and being watched to make sure you're not causing any harm or going down the wrong treatment pathways. From there, once you complete that, you sit your national paramedic written. I'm a nationally certified paramedic, so I had to sit that written, and then finally a practical examination. And once you pass all that, you, you're certified to be a paramedic.
And so with respect to both your training as far as becoming an EMT and then your training as far as becoming a paramedic, there's sort of a written portion and a practical portion as well. Is that correct?
Correct.
Can you use the term in there as far as a preceptor? What exactly does that mean within your field?
So a preceptor is a senior paramedic who's been practicing for, it varies from place to place, but the standard is usually 3 to 5 years, who will watch you to make sure that you're not, like I said, drifting down the wrong path in terms of treatment, making sure that your care is adequate and not doing any harm. My preceptors that I was with, they were medics in the city of Brockton, so they had been around for a little while, and they were excellent at what they did, and they taught me quite a bit. I learned quite a bit in my ride time from them.
And in your role, post getting your certification in regard to those, have you acted as a preceptor for other sort of younger, less experienced?
Yeah, so I was a field training officer for the Cataldo for a brief stint right before I left the company. And I am currently a field training officer for the town of Canton.
And with respect to those certifications, is that sort of like a one-time blessing in perpetuity, or is there a continuing educational recertification process?
Right now for the town of Canton, that's a bidded position. I submitted an application writing and I was selected. So I am currently on my group. I am our field training officer for my group, group two.
Okay. And my apologies, poor question on my part. I was asking sort of more in general. So beyond the sort of preceptor, sort of faction of that, just in regard to in general being an EMT and a paramedic, as far as your certifications are concerned, is that something that you have to continue? Is there any sort of recertification process, and how often is that?
Oh, I apologize. Okay, yes. So every 2 years, we're required, both by the national component and the state component, to complete certain amount of hours per year for your recertification. I actually just recently recertified in March. I can't speak to the exact number of hours, but there's a national component, state component, and a local component, and the trainings are quite in-depth.
Now, turning your attention to your work with the Canton Fire Department, how many fire stations are there within the town of Canton?
We have two fire stations.
Okay, and where are they located?
Station 1 is 99 Revere Street, and Station 2 is 7 Sassamon Street.
And when you're working with the Canton Fire Department, is there a typical kind of schedule or shift schedule that you're working on?
So my work schedule is I work one 24-hour shift, one 24-hour off, one 24-hour shift on, and then five consecutive 24s off.
And as far as the 24-hour shift, what time to what time does that run with the Canton Fire?
For us, we report at 0800 to 0800.
So 8 a.m. to 8 a.m.?
Yes.
And within both of those station houses, how much sort of apparatus or how many different sort of vehicles and apparatus do you have within each of those station houses?
For Station 1, 99 Revere Street, we have Car 5 staffed with a captain. We have Engine 3 staffed with one lieutenant, two firefighters, and Ambulance 1, who is staffed with two firefighters. We do have a PB waiver, so we will run paramedic basic on Ambulance 1. However, that is primarily a double medic ambulance. And for Station 2, it's a very similar setup. It is Engine 4 with two firefighters and a lieutenant, and Ambulance 2 with the same setup as Ambulance 1. Both those stations also have ladders that run out of them, Ladder 1 and Ladder 2 respectively. And the crews from Ambulance 1 or Ambulance 2 will crossband those ladders as needed.
Now, with respect, if I could turn your attention to January 28th into January 29th, sort of Friday into a Saturday. Do you recall 2022? Do you recall those days? Okay, were you working one of those 2 days?
I was scheduled to work the morning of the 29th, I believe.
So you were scheduled to work essentially the morning, 8 a.m. on the 29th until 8 a.m. on the 30th?
Correct.
And prior to, were the 28th sort of going into the 29th, what, if anything, were you aware of as far as weather that had been forecasted or that was reported to come?
I was aware that there was a significant storm, supposedly. Well, there was a significant storm coming through. I woke up very early that morning just to check. I took a peek outside at my house. I live in the city of Brockton. I noticed that the conditions were, it was starting to snow a little bit. So I got up early and got ready for work and left earlier than I normally do.
And about what time, which station were you assigned to on that?
I was at Station 1, 99 Revere Street, and I was on Ambulance 1 for the day.
And about what time did you arrive at Station 1?
Due to the inclement weather, I believe I arrived several hours early. I showed up to the station around 5:45, 5:50 that morning.
And around the time that you were driving from your home to Station 1 in Canton, what, if anything, did you note as far as sort of driving conditions, visibility, anything else?
The snow was starting to accumulate. The roads, I drove through several towns, but the roads were starting to be treated, but they weren't pristine. There was obviously a buildup of snow starting on my ride, which was part of the reason I left early, just either to relieve people if they needed to get out before the storm really hit, or just to help them with snow removal.
And to that point, when it comes to sort of snow removal at the fire station, what, if any, sort of duties and responsibilities do yourself and the other firefighters have to in relation to snow removal around the station?
So we're responsible around the station to keep what we refer to as the apron clear of snow. The apron is where we back our fire trucks into and out of the station. So we remove all that ourselves. We have a plow truck. However, we'll also shovel walkways and stuff for the public if they need to get in. So that was one of the primary, for the crew was actually outside removing snow when I pulled in to the station that morning.
And it may be pretty self-explanatory, but as far as the apron itself, why is it so necessary that the apron remain clear as far as snow is concerned?
Just to maintain a path for the emergency apparatus to get in and out in a timely manner.
Now, beyond sort of the snow accumulation that you noted on your way to work that day, what, if anything, else did you note as far as the weather conditions, whether it be temperature, winds, anything to that effect?
They were approaching blizzard conditions. It was windy. It was still very early in the morning, so it was quite dark, and it was windy and snowy. So we were approaching blizzard conditions, like I said.
And when you arrived there, did a call come into your station sometime around or shortly after 6 o'clock in the morning on the 29th?
Yeah, I arrived, as I previously stated, around 5:50. I had put my gear, my firefighting structural gear, out with Ambulance 1 just in the event that there was an emergency. And as I was doing that, the emergency tones went off for a medical.
Do you recall what was the report in regard to, what was the dispatch in regard to as far as the medical was concerned?
The overhead dispatch came in as a unresponsive male in a snowbank at 34 Fairview Road, outside, unclear any further information. So when that came on, we had one of the paramedics that morning and one of the firefighters who was a relatively new firefighter. I made the decision to step onto the ambulance to provide an extra set of hands as one of the more senior paramedics in the station at the time.
And correct me if I'm wrong, when you step onto the ambulance, you're essentially still sort of getting your gear on and getting dressed, correct?
Correct. I was, as the tones were going off, and because I came in so early, I was still in civilian clothing. I had a Canton Fire t-shirt on. So I actually donned my turnout gear for that call.
And as far as the other individuals on that Ambulance 1 that were going to that call as well, who were they?
So it was firefighter paramedic Anthony Flamati and firefighter EMT Matt Kelly.
And Mr. Kelly, he was sort of the less experienced one at that time. Is that correct?
Correct.
So you get into the back of the ambulance and start going to the scene. Now, as far as other sort of vehicles or apparatus, who, if anyone, or what, if any, other sort of vehicles were dispatched on this call as well?
The initial dispatch was Canton Engine 3 and Canton Ambulance 1. Due to the severity of the call, depending on how it comes in, the shift commander, which is Car 5, he will usually respond to any significant incident. So he also added himself to the call just as a senior officer with us. So the final dispatch, I believe, was Car 5, Engine 3, and Ambulance 1.
You know who was on Engine 3 and who was in Car 5?
Car 5 was Captain Robry. Engine 3 was Lieutenant Greg Woodbury, Firefighter Frank Walsh, and Firefighter Katie McLaughlin.
As far as the Ambulance 1 that you were in, obviously there's somebody driving and there's somebody in the front passenger seat, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So who was driving and who was in the front passenger seat?
I don't want to speak out of turn. I honestly can't tell you who was driving. I was in the back. I was in the back patient compartment of the ambulance, just because there's only two seats up front. So I hopped in the back.
Okay. And so when you're in the back of the ambulance and you're going to the call, what is it that you're doing in sort of preparation for arrival?
So as I previously stated, I was I came in early, so I was donning my turnout gear. I had my boots and structural firefighting pants on. So I finished putting those on and I put the rest of my gear in the back. And as we were driving to the scene of the incident, I started prepping the gear that we were going to need off the initial dispatch and unresponsive mail in the snow. So I grabbed our first in bag, which has miscellaneous medical supplies, some IV supplies and interosseous, drill kit. The airway bag, which has just a bottle of oxygen and then quite a bit of airway management supplies, and our cardiac monitor. So I had all of those prepped out and ready to go. So we, as soon as the ambulance was in park, we could step right out, ascertain what we had, and go from there. So when the ambulance arrived on scene, I had all three of those bags on my person, and we were able to, the entire ambulance crew was able to step out and provide patient care.
And as far as, if you know, approximately how much time elapsed between the time that you hear sort of the sound go off and you get in the ambulance to the time that you arrive on scene on Fairview?
I couldn't give you an accurate estimation of the time. Like I said, I was in the back. I was trying to prep everything and get myself kind of prepped just in terms of appropriate attire. So I couldn't give you a fair estimate.
And as far as when you arrive on scene, you step out of the back of the ambulance, is that correct?
Yes.
And as far as the weather conditions, where you were on Fairview, what, if any, difference was there between the weather conditions there versus the weather conditions when you were arriving at the station?
I remember, as I previously stated, I remember it was still very dark. The sun was not up yet. I remember the wind. It was quite windy that morning. The wind had, in my opinion, had seemed to have picked up since my drive in, and the snow was increased.
And so when you step out of the ambulance, can you describe for the jury sort of where you go and sort of what is it that you first see when you get out there?
So I stepped out of the ambulance and came around with all three bags. I could hear a commotion. I could hear some screaming off in the distance. I couldn't really tell you where it was coming from because it was still quite dark. Came around the passenger side of the ambulance, walked in front of the ambulance, And there was a small huddle of three individuals and what appeared to be a human form laying in the snow. So we made our way over to that and went from there.
And when you come around the passenger side of the ambulance and you observe that and start from there, are you sort of turning left or right, or how are you heading when you come around the ambulance?
I came out of the ambulance on the passenger side and I took a left.
And you make your way over to the patient on the ground, is that correct?
Correct.
And as far as the other people that you observed around the patient, how would you, or what, if any, description do you have of those?
There were three individuals. I believe they were all three of them were female. My primary focus was the individual in the snow on the ground. I went right to him. I kind of bypassed everybody from there and went directly to that individual.
Is that sort of typically how you approach a scene? Is just sort of tunnel vision right for the patient?
typically on a call like that, where if somebody's unresponsive on the ground, you typically go directly to the patient and ascertain any, if they are breathing and if they have signs of life, because that is a time-sensitive matter.
And as far as the individual, not then, but at some point subsequent, did you learn the identity of the person on the ground?
It did. It was Officer O'Keefe, John O'Keefe.
And how was Officer Mr. O'Keefe's body positioned in relation to the ground when you first approached him?
So I found him supine, laying in the snow. Immediately went to him and checked him for signs of life. We found none. We found no breathing, no pulse. So we immediately began performing high quality CPR. I was at the head of the individual, so I immediately grabbed out of our airway bag a bag valve mask and began ventilating the patient, trying to get some oxygen into him while the others on scene, like I said, began high quality CPR.
And again, maybe pretty well understood. When you use the term supine, what exactly do you mean?
He was laying on his back.
Laying on his back, his head sort of facing up. Is that correct?
Correct.
And when you are responding to a call of this nature, there's you and there's other individuals on the ambulance as well, correct?
Correct.
And is there a certain division as far as treatment and diagnosis and things of that nature are concerned between you and the other people on the ambulance?
So typically, just to use the scenario of a cardiac arrest with two paramedics, it's generally split into the airway individual or the airway monitor and the, lack of a better term, code monitor. The airway individual will be responsible for ventilation and eventually advanced airway placement. The other part of that equation will monitor cardiac status, cardiac activity. They will deliver medications and a route for those medications, and they will work together to monitor that patient throughout. As I said, I was on the head. I just happened to fall at the head. So I took the ventilation portion of that.
And you use the term as far as a bag valve mask, is
yep.
that correct? And
correct.
Can you explain to the jury sort of what that is?
All that is it's, for lack of a better term, it's basically a glorified balloon with a mask on it. When you squeeze that bag, that forces air into the airway so you can ventilate an individual who is no longer breathing on their own.
And as far as obviously with your work with the fire department, there are sort of records or reports that are written in regard to treatment of different individuals on any given call, correct?
Correct.
Is there an acronym that's used within those reports as far as bag valve masks?
BVM.
And turning back to sort of when you initially approach where Mr. O'Keefe is, if you know, about how far away from, where is he in relation to, well, let me back up. Okay. So you arrive at this residence at 34 Fairview Road, correct?
Yep.
Okay. So if I'm standing on the street and I'm facing Fairview Road, is Mr. O'Keefe's body to the left, to the right, center, or something else?
I would say to the left of center.
And what, if anything, did you sort of note or observe sort of in the general area as far as where Mr. O'Keefe was?
In terms of when I got to him?
Yes.
So when I first got to him, we checked for signs of life, and I was, as stated, at the head. There was a small pool of blood that seemed to be underneath him. It was hard to ascertain, again, because of the conditions. It was still very dark. It was snowing. And it was quite windy. So we were able to check the area as best we could with our handheld lights. But that was one of the things that I noted. There was just a pool of blood.
Now, where Mr. O'Keefe's body was in relation to the roadway, if you know, about how far away, where was it in relation to the roadway?
I estimated it about where the sidewalk met the front lawn of that residence. That would be my best estimation.
You have any estimate as far as footage or anything like that?
I would say about 6-8 feet, perhaps.
Approximately 6 to 8 feet from the curb?
Correct.
So you indicated that what are the first things that you're checking as far as when you first arrive at a patient for this time?
I'm sorry, could you repeat?
That's okay. It's my fault. So as far as when you... Let me back you up for just one second.
Sorry.
You used a term in there as far as a cardiac arrest, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Can you explain to the jury what you understand that term to mean based on your training experience?
So cardiac arrest is the cessation of a stable cardiac rhythm in terms of life. Typically, it's either asystole, pulseless electrical activity, or VFib or VTAC. Typically, you ascertain that, but there's no pulse. You check any of the pulses, be it a femoral pulse, a carotid pulse, or a radial pulse, you will find nothing. And when that is found, you go to life-saving measures, which is CPR.
And just in reference to one other term you used in there as far as asystole, if you could explain to the jury what you understand that term to mean based on your training experience.
Asystole, to put it as clear as I can, is a flat line. There's no electrical activity in the heart.
And so you're working sort of at the head of Mr. O'Keefe, is that correct?
Correct.
And sort of while he's still on the ground, and what is it that you're specifically sort of doing in reference to your treatment at that point?
So I was, as we talked about earlier, I had a BVM, bag valve mask, and I had Mr. O'Keefe, I was ventilating him. So I had the mask on his face, and I was giving him positive pressure breaths with that BVM.
And as you're doing that, what, if anything else, did you observe beyond sort of the blood pooling you've already talked about as far as any tactile observations you made of Mr. O'Keefe, any visual observations you made of Mr. O'Keefe at that point outside of the ambulance?
He was dressed for the weather. He had several layers on. Other than that, our primary focus was kind of getting him extricated and out of the elements, just because it was, as stated, conditions were suboptimal, and we wanted to get him into an environment with better lighting and some heat so we could further assess if he had any injuries and go from there.
And so the other firefighters, paramedics, excuse me, that are on the ambulance with you, while you're doing sort of the back valve mask at his head, what, if anything, are they doing?
I believe the other firefighters that were dispatched, they were getting extrication equipment. I believe we put this individual on what we refer to as a scoop stretcher, which is basically a long plastic stretcher that we can roll an individual onto and then just pick him up just for our safety and the safety of the patient. It's just really just a long board that we can pick up and then put onto our ambulance stretcher. So somebody was grabbing the scoop stretcher, somebody else was grabbing the ambulance stretcher, and I believe that was a coordinated effort on their part.
And I apologize for keep going back and forth, but if I could take you back just one moment before that. So when you first sort of arrived to Mr. O'Keefe, you mentioned that there are three females sort of huddled around. Is that correct?
Correct.
What, if anything, did you observe any of those females doing with respect to Mr. O'Keefe when you first got there?
That group seemed to be agitated. It was a scene of heightened emotions. As I stated, when I stepped out of the ambulance, I could hear screaming. I could hear people yelling. And it seemed just to be, that group was just quite agitated.
Now, at some point you are able to get them on the scoop stretcher and then over to the ambulance, correct?
Correct.
And when you get to the ambulance, what, if anything, did you note as far as what, if any, difference was there in the lighting in the back of the ambulance versus on the front lawn?
The lighting was significantly better. All of our ambulances have fluorescent lighting in the ceiling of the ambulance. So those were on, and we were able to see that there was some more injuries once we were able to get him out of his winter clothing.
And so to that point, when you sort of first get into the back of the ambulance, what is sort of the protocol? What is it that each of you are sort of doing with respect to patient care at that point?
So the biggest priority is continuous high quality CPR. And that is the biggest thing with any cardiac arrest is uninterruption of compressions. So when we got him into the back of the ambulance, we continued CPR throughout. So while multiple people were performing CPR and eventually a mechanical CPR device was applied, those compressions were uninterrupted and others were removing clothing, I honestly couldn't tell you the number of articles of clothing, but I believe a winter jacket and a sweatshirt were removed. And then eventually he was, all the clothing was removed, and that's protocol for any cardiac arrest or any traumatic injury is usually all clothing is removed so we can have unfettered access to the individual to see if there are any other injuries.
And why is that protocol?
You mentioned earlier, sir, that there is tunnel vision. The absence of clothing kind of helps to remove that, so you can see everything. You can assess everything.
And you mentioned sort of a mechanical means of CPR. Is there a specific device that's used for that?
Yes, yeah, so we use a Lucas device manufactured by Stryker. And for lack of a better term, it's basically just a plunger that does CPR. It frees up a set of hands for us, and that can provide CPR uninterrupted as long as the batteries last.
Now, at the time that you get him into Mr. O'Keefe into the back of the ambulance and you removing some of the clothing, what, if anything, did you note at that time or at any subsequent time in regard to footwear?
To be candid, I wasn't really looking at the footwear. I believe it was brought to my attention when we eventually transferred patient care at Good Samaritan Medical Center that the individual was missing a shoe. However, that wasn't my primary focus at the time.
And the items of clothing that were removed from within the ambulance, eventually when you transfer that patient care to the hospital, what, if anything, happens with that?
In terms of the chain of custody of the clothing, that is typically brought in either with the individual or after. And that is usually deposited on the floor of the room where that patient is. And then the hospital takes custody of it. Occasionally we'll put it in bags. However, I could not speak to where that clothing went on this case.
But fair to say whatever clothing was taken off in the ambulance left the ambulance at some point.
Correct.
Went to the hospital, is that correct?
Yes.
Now, when you have Mr. O'Keefe in the back of the ambulance and the lighting is better, what, if anything, did you observe following sort of the removal of the clothing as far as what, if any, injuries did you observe to Mr. O'Keefe in that sense?
He was noted to have, and I was right at the head, he was noted to have a hematoma on the right side of his face, just above his eye on his forehead. And there was some scratches on the right arm, the upper arm.
And use the term as far as a hematoma. Could you explain what you understand that term to me?
Lack of a better term is just an egg. He had a pretty good egg on his head.
And as far as anything beyond that, did you observe anything or note anything beyond the egg on the head and the scratches on the right arm?
As we got further down our treatment modality, we went to place an advanced airway. It was noted to have some blood, some mucus, and some bile in the back of his airway that was then suctioned out before we placed our endotracheal tube.
And what is an endotracheal tube?
So an endotracheal tube is basically, it's just a plastic tube that is passed through the mouth into the trachea through the vocal cords. It's a definitive airway, if you will. It isolates the trachea so you can better ventilate your patient. And you don't have to worry about any any air getting into the stomach, any gastric insufflation. And that is the gold standard for cardiac arrest, is a properly placed intraocular tube.
Mentioned there were some substances that were suctioned from his airway. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And what were they again? I'm sorry.
I believe it was blood, bile, and mucus.
And do you have any idea how much of that was suctioned?
I couldn't give you an exact number, but it was enough that we needed to set up a suction system to remove it before we intubated.
And just turning briefly again to the arm. These were injuries that you observed on his right arm. Is that correct?
Correct.
What, if any, injuries did you observe on his left arm?
I don't believe I saw any, to my knowledge.
And as far as your memory, as far as his right arm, how far did it sort of extend, and where was it located? Sort of upper arm, lower arm, both, or where was it?
I believe it was just below his shoulder. They ran, I would say, probably 3 or 4 inches from, I would say, about the shoulder right down to maybe 2 inches above the elbow.
And as far as Mr. O'Keefe's nose, what, if any, observations did you make of that?
Initially, it was noted to be very cold. The individual was cold all around to the touch, but his nose was also quite cold, quite white, just because he had been in the elements for a little while. There appeared to be a little bit of blood on his nose as well.
And through your training experience, are you familiar with a term or a device known as an OPA?
Correct, yes.
Can you explain to the jury sort of what OPA stands for, and what is that device? What does it do?
So an OPA, or oral pharyngeal airway, is basically a small plastic device that is curved. And when inserted into the mouth, all it does is it prevents the tongue from falling backwards into the airway and occluding the airway. It's relatively simple, but it's very effective in keeping an airway open.
Just turning back for one moment to the injuries that you observed on Mr. O'Keefe's right arm, were those injuries that were actively bleeding at the time that you observed them?
No.
What, if anything, did you observe as to that in reference to those injuries on the arm?
Those injuries seem to have been congealed. In my opinion, it looked like they had been cold, which could have aided in the clotting of those injuries. But when we observed them, they were not bleeding.
And you mentioned a little bit about Mr. O'Keefe's nose. What, if any, observations did you make as far as any sort of digits, whether they be his hand, his feet, or something else?
So all of his digits on the upper extremities were noted to, they were very cold. They were immobile. They were very stiff. I'm presuming due to the exposure, because we did, when we got him onto the ambulance, when we were removing clothing, it was noted that he was very, all of his digits were very stiff. They were immobile, and it caused a little bit of problems just trying to get clothing off of him, just because they were so, so stiff.
And taking you back outside of the ambulance just for a moment, mm-hmm. when you're sort of initially there and you're doing your assessment, and the three females are in your general area, correct?
Correct.
And at some point, can you or any of the other paramedics or EMTs on scene ask them any questions about what had happened or anything like that?
So as I was ventilating at the head, there was a small delay in just getting equipment, nothing significant, just enough time that as I was ventilating, I was able to ask, did anybody see anything? Did anybody, what happened? And there was one individual that replied several times, I hit him.
And did you know that individual at that time?
I did not.
Can you describe the individual that said that?
I would describe her as mid-40s, average build, average height. And the other two, very similar.
And with reference to that statement of, I hit him, is that something that she said once or more than once or something?
It was several times.
And as far as the tone or demeanor, was this, how loudly was this being said?
As previously stated, it was they seemed to be erratic. There was a lot going on in that scene. It did seem to be said over and over and at varying volumes. And then there was just a lot of everybody appeared to be quite flustered.
And the individual, one of the three females that said that, what, if any, observations did you make as to her face or anything?
The individual that said, I hit him, appeared to have some blood on her face, presumably for attempting CPR prior to our arrival.
And you say presumably attempting CPR. When you first arrived at Mr. O'Keefe, what, if anything, did you observe any of the females doing with reference to Mr. O'Keefe?
Mr. O'Keefe was not being touched by any individual when I first got to him. That whole group was kind of pacing around, lack of better term, kind of running around in circles. But Mr. O'Keefe was not being, there was no interventions being done to Mr. O'Keefe when I got to him.
And to be clear, sort of when you're in the back, fast forwarding now to sort of in the back in the ambulance, you're, again, sort of focused on the respiratory in the head, correct?
Correct.
And who, if anyone else from your apartment, is in the back of the ambulance, and what, if anything, are they doing at that
point? So at that point, I had myself and Nat Kelly, EMT Kelly. He was kind of with me for the head. One of the, for lack of a better term, easier operations of a cardiac arrest is ventilation. So Matt Kelly was assisting me with ventilations, is just squeezing the BVM to provide ventilation. The lead paramedic for the cardiac arrest was Anthony Flamati. He was running everything else. He was running the application of the cardiac monitor. He was monitoring the status of medications being administered. He was assisted with that by Katie McLaughlin, Lieutenant Woodbury, and Firefighter Walsh.
And at some point, did Firefighter Flamati, at this point that you're in the back of the ambulance, you don't have any sort of demographic information in regard to your patient, correct?
Correct.
So what, if anything, did Firefighter Flamati ask anybody else to do in regard to obtain?
I believe he asked Firefighter McLaughlin to exit the ambulance and gather some information from the bystanders in terms of name, date of birth, any significant medical history or medications, just so we could further treat the patient.
And to the best of your knowledge, Firefighter McLaughlin leaves the ambulance to do that, is that correct?
Correct.
But you weren't present for any of that, correct?
No.
So there's some period of time in the back of the ambulance and then the transport to Good Samaritan happens, is that correct?
Correct.
You recall where different people from your department were in relation to that transport to the hospital?
So the transport in the back in the patient compartment was myself, Firefighter Kelly, and Firefighter Flamati, with Firefighter McLaughlin driving Ambulance One.
I have just one moment. Right?
Yes.
So, when it comes to the report that we were that you were testifying about before, there was a report generated in regard to this. Is that correct?
Correct.
And who is sort of who has the sort of duty and responsibility of compiling that?
That would have been Anthony Flamati.
And have you seen Firefighter Flamati's report in relation to this incident?
I have.
May I approach the witness, Sean?
Yes.
All
right.
Thank you. Do you recognize that, sir?
I do.
And what do you recognize that?
This is what I believe to be the ENFERS report written by Captain Robery and the patient care report written by firefighter Flamati.
Thank you, sir. May I approach, John?
Yes.
I'm open to seek to introduce and admit as the next exhibit, I believe.
It's already pre-marked, or are you moving to introduce it now? Is there an objection?
I may have just one more.
Okay.
No objection.
Patient care report.
All right, that will be marked, Madam Court Reporter, please. 160.
And
thank you very much.
Officer, if I could ask for the lights in the little. And Ms. Gilman, if I could have what's been previously marked as exhibit number 9. Mr. Nuttall, just directing your attention up to the screen there and what's been previously marked as exhibit number 9. Do you recognize what's depicted in that photograph?
I do.
What do you recognize?
I believe that to be 34 Fairview Road.
Is that a relatively fair and accurate portrayal of what it looked like around the time that you arrived there, absent sort of lighting conditions and things of that nature?
Yes.
And Ms. Gilman, if I could have exhibit number 18. May I approach the witness, Sean?
Yes.
All right.
And Mr. Nuttall, if I could ask you, using that laser pointer before you, well, first let me ask, do you recognize what's up on the screen as Exhibit 18?
Yes. Again, 34 Fairview Road.
And the area where you first observed Mr. O'Keefe supine on the lawn and the three females around him, you see that area in this photograph?
I do.
And if you could, using that laser pointer, just direct the jury's attention to where in this photograph you see that.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I would say right around this general area, right about here.
And lastly, Ms. Gilman, if I could have exhibit number 14. And again, sir, do you recognize what's up on the screen as exhibit number 14?
I do.
What do you recognize that?
That I believe to be is where we found Mr. O'Keefe.
And as far as the pooling of the blood that you observed around Mr. O'Keefe's head, you observed that area within this photograph as well?
Yes.
You could, again, using that laser pointer, just direct the jury's attention to where in this photograph you observed that.
They were right around in this general area. Yeah.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Officer, we can have the lights back up. Your Honor, may I approach just to retrieve that?
Light? Yes.
I have no further questions for this witness at this time, Your Honor.
All right, cross examination.
Thank you, Your Honor. Afternoon, firefighter Nuttall.
Sir, how are you?
You were coming up, I want to make sure I get the timing right. You were coming off of nearly a 24-hour shift when you got the call?
No, sir. I was reporting for duty that morning.
Just starting the shift when you got the call. Understood. I want to ask one quick question that you mentioned just a couple of seconds ago under questioning by Mr. Lally. With regard to the clothing, the normal protocol for clothing that's removed from a patient.
Yes.
You said it's oftentimes just sort of discarded onto the floor.
In terms of in the ambulance or at the hospital?
Either one.
Yes.
Okay. Both?
So typically, when we remove clothing in the back of the ambulance, it's generally done with trauma shears. So we will expose and then kind of fold over. That clothing is then usually left in place. We'll do a quick roll just to check the back of the patient, and then he's usually rolled back if there's nothing found, and it's typically left there. In terms of like big puffy jackets, if you cut a puffy jacket, it just makes quite the mess. So
pillow.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's a disaster. So typically those bigger jackets are just removed, and that is when we removed that type of article of clothing, that's when we noticed that his hands were quite rigid.
So that's what happened in this case.
Correct.
You removed the big heavy jacket, discarded it, got it away from the body so you could better assess the injuries.
Correct.
And it was only then, after you removed this big heavy winter coat, that you could assess that his hands were stiff and cold.
We noted the hands, but it came more into light, if you will, when we removed that coat.
Got it. And you have a as good a memory about that as you do the rest of the scene that morning.
In terms of removing the article of clothing?
Correct.
I did not remove any article of clothing. I was ventilating.
But you remember him having the big jacket on?
Correct.
Okay. And you remember that as well as you remember the other specifics of the incident?
Yes.
Okay. When responding to a scene, I want to dovetail on the same subject, but just come at it a little bit different way, if you indulge me. When responding to a scene, one of your jobs has to be to sort of immediately take note of and assess the situation of the patient that you're dealing with, correct?
Correct.
A motorcycle accident is going to be very different than a drowning.
Exactly.
Someone, in this case, exposed in a snowbank, you're going to deal with or assess and note the weather.
Mm-hmm.
Is that yes?
Yes.
You're also going to note and assess the condition of the patient.
Correct.
As it pertains to the weather.
Yes.
So someone, for instance, that's in a snowbank naked,
mm-hmm.
no clothes on at all, is going to be a little bit different assessment than someone who's completely dressed for winter, correct?
The initial assessment with every patient is going to be automatically circulation, airway, breathing.
Understood.
We approach that this individual the exact same way. Is automatically went directly to cardiac. Make sure.
I guess what I'm asking is your attention is focused on some of those details for sure.
Correct.
And that's how you remember that big heavy coat that he was wearing, correct?
I remember he was appropriately dressed, correct.
Okay. As a matter of fact, you testified to that in the grand jury that, quote unquote, he had a heavy coat on.
Yes.
Consistent with how you're testifying today. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. Your Honor, I'd like to mark two photographs as next in order. They've not yet been marked. I believe it would be 160.
It doesn't matter so much the number, but why don't you just show the prosecutor the photos?
161 and 162 in order. May I approach?
Yes.
Look at those.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to ask you, first of all, whether or not you recognize what's depicted in those photos.
Honestly, sir, I couldn't recall the exact, but yeah.
You do recognize them?
Yes.
Does that appear to be what John O'Keefe is wearing when you found them?
I don't recall, sir, to be perfectly honest.
May I approach you?
Yes.
Do you recall this being part of, let me ask it a different way. Do you remember somebody cutting this off of John O'Keefe at the time?
I remember the clothing being removed.
Okay, but you don't remember this clothing?
I could say that he had clothing removed, but I couldn't tell you exactly what it was.
And you've just looked at these. This, what I'm holding in my hand, appears to be the front and back of a...
So don't hold it up to him from that distance where he said he doesn't recognize it. You can put it back in front of him. Don't hold it up for the jury, please.
May I?
Yes.
You.
That appeared to be a thin cotton hoodie.
Yeah, that appears to be a thinner layer of clothing.
Okay. May I approach?
Yes.
Not a heavy coat.
That's fair.
Fair.
Not a winter jacket.
Fair.
Is it fair to say you had a lot on your mind when you were out at that scene, correct?
In terms of just a cut.
Saving a man's life.
Correct.
That's your credentials are impressive. You were there focused on one thing, and that is trying to make sure that a man did not die.
Correct.
Would you agree that that was your primary concern and your primary focus the entire time you were at the scene?
Correct.
You weren't necessarily worried about what other individuals were doing, correct?
No.
If I asked you right now off the top of your head, tell me exactly the number of law enforcement officers that were there at the scene, probably couldn't tell me, could you?
No.
If I asked you whether or not you remember every single civilian that was at the scene, probably couldn't tell me, correct?
Outside of the three?
Outside of the three.
Correct.
Any other civilians?
Not that I noted.
Okay. Matter of fact, you can't even identify the three civilians other than generally middle-aged, 40s, Caucasian, female.
Correct.
You said all three of them sort of looked alike, right?
Without, the only defining feature on one of the individuals was one of the individuals did have blood on their face.
So some of the specifics of that scene you didn't pay special note to, correct?
No, we were focused on patient care.
Is it fair to say that, specifically as it pertains to what the victim was wearing, your memory might be a little faulty where that's concerned?
Sure.
Okay. I mean, nothing wrong with that. You were focused on something completely different.
Correct.
You did notice certain injuries on Mr. O'Keefe's person, correct?
Correct.
And you indicated on direct examination that once you got him into the back of the ambulance, you, as you put it, you had a quote-unquote much better picture of what you were dealing with. Is that right?
Correct.
You testified at the grand jury that you noted that once he was in the back of the ambulance, under better lighting, you were able to tell that he had trauma to the right side of his head.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
Are you talking about the major trauma that he suffered to the back of his head or the egg that you earlier described?
I was more, just because it was directly in front of me, it was on the front side of his head.
Okay. So it wasn't the right side of his head. If you said right side of your head, you might point above your ear, right?
Correct.
That's not
yes.
where you're talking about.
I was, and if, to use my person, I would say right here. So more towards the right, above his right eye.
Right of center, but still on the front of his head.
Correct.
Okay. And you did not make any note of another injury on the back of his head?
No.
You talked about the injuries to the right side of his arm. Correct?
Correct.
You noted that those injuries appeared to be scratches.
Yes.
That's your word, not mine, right?
Correct.
You didn't say that those were blunt force trauma?
No.
You didn't say that they were abrasions?
Scratches and abrasions, in my point of view, seem to go hand in hand.
But the word that you used was scratches.
Yes, they were like furrows. Down.
Say that again?
Furrows, if you will, for lack of a better term. Just
I don't understand that word.
So if you remove something,
yes.
like you create a furrow in the skin, is that?
Furrows.
Yes, there you go. Sorry. Excuse my accent.
Oh, no. I'm on your turf.
Fair enough.
It's my accent. I'm so sorry. Boy, that one. It's going to be a meme somewhere.
Hey, my cousin Vinny.
Yeah, got it. All right. So when you said furrows, you made your hand in almost like a claw and drug it against your right biceps.
Jackson.
Sustained.
Can you repeat the movement that you did for the jurors when you said furrows?
Jackson.
Sustained. Just move on to the next question, please.
You would agree that a very common cause of a hematoma over one's eye is being hit or punched.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
You said that Mr. O'Keefe did have such a hematoma over his right eye, correct?
Yes.
Did you also see a laceration under the eyebrow but above the lid on his right eye?
I don't recall.
Did you see a laceration on Mr. O'Keefe's nose?
I don't recall.
You did note that there was some blood on his nose, correct?
Correct.
That possible that came from a small laceration?
Yes.
In your experience, well, let me ask another question. Did it look like he had, in addition to the egg on the right side of his head, in the front, did it also have a black eye on the left side?
If memory serves correct, yes.
So both eyes were blackened?
Primarily the right side, if memory serves.
Okay. And the laceration toward the right side?
Yes.
Of the right eye. Are those injuries that you've just described consistent or inconsistent with some sort of physical altercation?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained. Next question, please.
Did it appear to you, just from your initial assessment, given your experience, training, and background, that those injuries looked like he had been in a fight?
Objection.
I'll see counsel at sidebar, please.
More raw courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed is coming up from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Press subscribe so you don't miss a minute.